Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 14th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is Gail Gamoff McCoy. Today's session is GAG 2001-02, and it's titled Trafficking in the U.S. Let's listen in.
A lot of information to cover today. I'm Gail Gamoff McCoy. I'm the Executive Director of Genesis House in Chicago, and I'm also a consultant for mental health and public health issues. This is part two in a four-part series that we're doing on trafficking and prostitution. For those of you who weren't here on Monday, I'll just briefly go over it. We're talking about international trafficking of mainly women and young girls for the purposes of prostitution, which has become a very serious problem. There are estimates of 700,000 up to 2 million women and girls being trafficked annually, sometimes by forcible kidnapping, sometimes being lured as to be waitresses or au pairs or whatever it might be. And yesterday we just sort of looked at internationally what are the issues. Today we're going to look at specifically how do they get into the country, what are some of the means that they get into the country, and then what happens with prostitution both here and in other countries once this happens to a young girl or a young woman. And I'd just like to say I know that this is, some of it's very unpleasant and some of it's very difficult to listen to, but I really believe that that's one of the reasons not a lot has been done about it until very recently. There's been some, just a little bit of work starting out in this field, because I think it's something we'd rather not look at. It's pretty ugly and it's sort of the underbelly of society, but it's a big, big problem. And tomorrow I'll be talking about what has started to be done in terms of international laws, in terms of laws about violence against women, and so on. And if anyone wants to get involved and to help, this will be some ideas of how you could get involved or at least be knowledgeable about what the laws are and who's promoting the laws and so on. So I'll first talk about how do they really get into this country? How do these women enter the United States when they're not legal? There's a couple of ways. First of all, it's the illegal use of legitimate documents, travel documents. Secondly, there are imposter passports that are used. And thirdly, there's entry without inspection. And I'll go into a little detail about each of the ways that this happens. Now, at the end of the session today, we'll have discussion and questions, and I've left time for that for anybody who wants to get further into these issues. What are the specifics of illegal entry? Well, the easiest way is really the visa, to overstay a visa that they get for someone. The newly independent states, or the NIS, Central and Eastern Europe, and Asia are the biggest ones at using visas and overstaying visas. There's a number of visas that they can acquire. One would be business, which is a B1. The other one would be tourist, which is a B2, and that's how they begin to bring the women into the United States. The visa length also varies from country to country, and because of the time and the length, they can actually recycle these visas and use them over and over again for women, different women, to keep getting into the country. Obviously, the longer the time of the visa, the more room there is for abuse of the visa system. Some visas have as long as a 10-year visa for multiple use, which a lot of people are not aware of, and they're easy to get, usually an entry visa. Some of the others that are used, but not as much as the ones I just mentioned, are student, which is an F1, fiancé, which is a K1, and entertainers, which is P1 and P3. The traffickers then, after they've gotten the particular visa for whatever you're supposed to be it a fiancé or an entertainer, will then coach the woman, and they will take care of getting all the documents for her that are supporting documents, bank accounts, all this type of thing that she needs to show legitimacy that she really is this fiancé or whatever she is. In other situations, passports are actually handed over then. If they do have this passport, they actually hand it over to the trafficker or the visa. So that gives the person a lot more control over her because he's keeping the documents for her. So he can control all the recruitment of this woman. The other thing that happens is what's called the abuse of the travel agency program. Now, sometimes they're legitimate travel agencies, sometimes they're illegitimate travel agencies. Some travel agencies are used unknowingly by the traffickers. And what happens is these embassies in small countries or poor countries are overburdened. And they actually use travel agencies to assist them with visas. And they also, these embassies do not have the time to investigate these different travel agencies. So again, they can be used as fronts for traffickers, or they can be used unknowingly, as I said. So that's what they do with visas, pretty much. The second thing is pretty basic. It's an imposter passports, as I had mentioned. That has to do with getting a photo substitute, substituting her photo, and recycling valid passports, which are often stolen. I don't know. I've had the personal experience of having my passport stolen in France, so I'm sure it was probably recycled somewhere with a new picture on it. So they just basically use a false passport and then get supporting documents again, which they manufacture. Because remember, for those of you who were here yesterday, this is organized crime. This is the third largest money maker for organized crime internationally. That is after guns and drugs, trafficking people. And why it's a better way to make money is because it happens to be a way to keep making money. Once you sell the drugs, they're gone. But with these women, you keep using them. And let's say they get $25 a customer. They're keeping $3, the woman, and the person who trafficked is keeping the rest of the profit. So that person keeps on making money for you. Another way to get in is to use what they call a jockey, which is a person who escorts her from the country to the United States. Normally, this is an Anglo-type-looking male who pretends to be her cousin, her fiancé, her brother, something of that nature. Sometimes these jockeys even marry the woman on paper, and then when they get to the United States, they don't live together, but they keep the marriage for 2 years, so it looks legitimate to the INS. Here's an extreme example. This isn't even someone who went to a travel agency unknowingly. There was a 22-year-old Chinese girl who was virtually kidnapped because she was attractive. She was brought to California on a ship from Taiwan, a fishing ship. She was smuggled in. When she got there, she was forced into prostitution, into a brothel. And Asian gangs are very, very active in the United States now in this trade. She was confined, and she was raped, and she was also tortured. She was able to escape and tell her story to the INS. And this is just to show you one of the more creative ways that they came up with to smuggle someone who was virtually kidnapped into the country. This isn't even through visas and passports and so on. The other thing they do is they will use ports of entry that are really not familiar. It's not like New York or somewhere else. They'll find somewhere where they don't think that the officials are on the ball. Or they'll come during late night flights or holidays when they think they'll have a little easier time and they won't be as vigilant about the passport. So then the next way and the last major way is entry without inspection. And I think you're pretty much familiar with this way. This goes on a lot over Canadian borders and Mexican borders. And this is basically, in Latin America, and they call these people coyotes. And I hate to keep doing this, but they call them, it's an odd term, they call them coyotes. And these people will either walk them across the border and or bring them in U-Hauls, vans, or buses. Now, if you sort of think about this, this is $700 to $2,000 per person, and the bus or the van or the U-Haul is loaded. And you might have heard stories about them being abandoned in the desert, and somebody opens the truck, and everybody in there's dead from heat or whatever it is. So sometimes they abandon them. Other times, as we talked about yesterday, they'll begin to extort more money from the family back home, and they'll say, well, you know, we're so far, we're to this point, but now you have to give us $2,000 more if you want your daughter to get across the border. And they'll go back and they'll threaten the families and extort the families and tell them that they're going to hurt her if they don't give more money. So these coyotes also exist from Canada to the United States. So the two points of entry there are borders for coyotes. Another way, and a less used way, is for them to book an international flight. And actually, the U.S. is the country in between that they're going to stop for the layover. So what happens is she will meet a trafficker there during the layover, and the trafficker will take her out of the airport, and they purposely miss the connecting flight to the other country. So as you can see, this has become a very sophisticated business, and they have many, many, many ways to do this. Major ports of entry in the United States in terms of airports are L.A., New York, Miami, Chicago's O'Hare, which is why we've become more familiar with this problem, and San Francisco. Some of the newer ports of entry, because these are beginning to be more watched, are Atlanta, Cleveland, Houston, Orlando, and Washington, D.C. So again, as I told you on yesterday, we're talking about 50,000 women and girls annually coming into this country. That's a lot of people. And another thing that they do now that they've gotten into the country is they will move them around the country. And there's a different reason for this. There's a number of reasons. One is that the clients want what they call fresh faces. So they don't want to see the same girl too often. So they might move her from city to city to city. And as new ones come in, they continue this sort of rotating. The other reason is to disorient the victims. So they're from one city to the next. They just don't know where they are or what's going on, or they don't know the language. So it's very disorienting, and they're being held as captives normally. The other thing is to prevent them from making friends or developing a relationship with one of the customers, because that person might feel sorry for them, might decide he wants to help them, get them out of that situation. So they want to prevent any relationships from developing, so they move them around. For example, in Florida, a lot of times there's a lot of Latina women there, and there's a Mexican group of women that are trafficked there. They're rotated every 15 days to 11 cities, and this includes cities in Florida and cities in the South. So you can see the extreme. I mean, that's 15 days, 11 cities that they're rotated to. It's very, very sophisticated again. Now, some of the other types of women and girls that are smuggled are oftentimes they could even be disabled, and if they're disabled, let's say deaf, vision problems, whatever it might be, they might be used for peddling and begging. And they do the same things with them when they're peddlers or beggars. They again move them and rotate them from city to city for the same reason, for disorientation and less likelihood of them figuring out how to contact the authorities and tell them what's going on in their lives. So that's pretty much basically how they get in. I thought that might be interesting because a lot of people ask that. And now pretty much we're going to shift gears a little bit to commercial exploitation. You know, what really happens to them when they come to this country. And one of the things you have to keep in mind about prostitution, that it's not just specific to prostitutes. It really bolsters gender inequality throughout. And one of the things that it affects is an increase in sexual violence against women, the harassment of women in the workplace, because we begin to think about women in a certain way, and it encourages this thought, and just basically violence against women by their partners. So when we see a lot of, and I know you've heard derogatory, even in rap music, the way they refer to women and they call them hoes and so on and so forth, it sort of permeates all of our society. It doesn't just stick in the little corner with the prostitute. It permeates our music, permeates our movies, our everything we see. And that's some of the results of treating women and thinking it's okay to treat women in that way. Basically, the global sex industry merchandises women. They're objectified in their merchandise. If they merchandise women for a number of things. Prostitution would be the first, and sex trafficking. Sex tourism is another, and yesterday I might have told you about places in Israel where they're literally behind glass on bleachers, and you go in, and they're all posing and trying to look frisky and happy, and they will pick, you know, the one that sort of appeals to them in some way. That's very common. That's called the sex tourism. And this is on the internet where you can go and where you can find the women and what they're like and descriptions of them and so on. Then also the mail order bride trade, which has become very big, you know, with the fall of communism, especially in those Eastern Bloc countries, and also pornography. Well, when we look at sexual exploitation, these practices become interconnected. They don't isolate from one another. They take multiple forms. So, example, if somebody's going to be prostituted, they may also force her to get into pornography. And there's now an international market for trafficking pornography as well. So she's not going to be able to just come and, for example, she might think, in some cases they do think they're going to be involved in the sex industry in some way. They may think that they're going to be a topless dancer or work in a strip club. They don't think they're going to be prostitutes. But what happens is once she agrees to do that, then she's going to be often forced into the prostitution and the pornography end of it. The other thing that's going to happen to her in this industry is that she'll be subjected to violence and very abusive sexual practices that are violent. And this is both women and children. So we want to glamorize, I think, the glossing over of prostitution and trying to make it pretty, as we did in Pretty Woman, which is a total fabrication of reality, not reality, non-reality. Because often, and we work personally, you know, with many prostitutes, the sex is disgusting, it's painful, it's humiliating, it's very similar to rape, it's dangerous, and there's unwanted bodily invasions in all areas of the body. Because again, this woman's dehumanized, she's not even real to that person. And some of the dehumanizing sexual practices that are used on women are because a non-prostituting woman would refuse. She would not agree to this type of sex. So they're forced into this type of sex that is usually maybe sadomasochistic, whatever it might be, but it's not healthy for either person. Also, what happens to the women is they begin to take drugs and alcohol. And many of the women in this country are addicted to drugs who are prostituting, and you will see that it's, you don't know really what came first, but now they have to prostitute to continue to for their drug habit. They have what we call a dissociative disorder often, or a disassociated mental status, which is completely removing yourself from the horror of the experience. And that later, when women get into recovery, which I'll talk a lot about on Thursday, is something that needs to be treated, because that's a defense mechanism and a disorder that's been developed so that they can continue to be victimized and have these horrific things happen to them. What are the consequences of prostitution? What happens when these women are trafficked? Well, not only is it injurious to your physical health, as I just mentioned, mental health, when I talk about dissociative disorders, it severely compromises a person's well-being and their physical well-being and their spiritual well-being. You're totally compromised when you're exploited in this way. Not only that, there's extreme health concerns. In a study that was done, and there's a number of studies here, more than 80% of women that are prostitutes get some type of sexually transmitted disease. 80%. More than they have chronic pelvic pain. They get pelvic inflammatory disease. They have unwanted pregnancies. In the case of trafficked women, they have unwanted abortions. Their babies are aborted whether they want that to happen or not. They have miscarriages, and then often down the road suffer from infertility as a result of this. They also have an increased rate of reproductive cancers from all of these different things that have happened to them. And the other problem is they have to acquiesce to the customer's demands. So if you want someone to wear a condom and they don't want to wear a condom, that could end in violence. You are not going to win that discussion, because he's paying you to do what he wants you to do. So you're not in a position to demand safe sex or demand condoms or anything else. You're at that person's mercy. So if you do get pregnant or you do get a disease of some sort, again, that's the non-caring about that individual, about that person, and letting them know, again, they don't really care about you. So if you look at the exploitation in the commercial sex industry, we're really looking at a death sentence for a lot of women. And there was a study done, and it was a 1998 study called Prostitution in 5 Countries. And, for example, HIV in Kenyan prostitutes was 52%. In Cambodian, it was 50%. In northern Thailand, 34%. In Bombay, 50%. Remember, these are children. These are girls and young women. I mean, it's teens down to 7 years old. some women that are involved in prostitution in these countries, and girls. And of the trafficked Burmese, which they were doing a study on, 50 to 70% had HIV or AIDS. Even in countries that distribute information about AIDS and HIV, there was a study done, for example, in Italy. In 1988, they had a 2% rate of HIV infection. In 1998, it had gone to 16%. That's just an idea of what the increase is in AIDS with prostitution. And also, some people, as I said, are sex tourists, so they're going from country to country and going to these hotels. They also are then exposed to extreme violence. This means beatings, rapes, torture, and even homicides. Now, in Chicago, one of the reasons we opened our third location was because there were unsolved murders of prostitutes, and they were mass murders. And there's murders daily, and we hear of someone almost every day, but this also there were mass murders just preying on prostitutes and killing them. This is not uncommon. This is not an uncommon practice at all. And again, I think when you look at the police trying to find the families and so on, and someone who cares about that individual at this point, it's usually very difficult. So a lot of people get away with killing women in prostitution. And we can tell you, we have stories of women that will tell you horrific stories, being pushed out of moving cars, being strangled, and just surviving. Most women have survived several attempted murders if they're in prostitution, if they're still alive, to tell you about it. The Canadian study on sex also talked about the mortality rate of women. When I talk about a death sentence, women in prostitution in Canada, and there are similar studies here, had a 40 times rate of mortality than other women. 40 times the rate of mortality. And that includes all of these things, the cancers, the homicides, and so on. So they're going to die much, much younger because of the abuse that they're suffering. And that's more than the national average. More effects of this kind of trafficking and prostitution. Psychological harm, which is normally never dealt with. And that's, again, in Chicago, we're trying to work with some type of clearing center that would debrief the woman and try and work on the psychological harm from what they've gone through. Suicidal feelings are very common. Clinical depression is very common. Dissociative disorders, very common. Personality disorders develop as well, and post-traumatic stress disorder, because the women really become trauma survivors. And again, for you who were here yesterday, there's a higher rate of post-traumatic stress syndrome in prostitutes. It's higher than Vietnam vets, and it's been documented. And so that's one thing when we look at recovery and treatment, that we have to be on top of our clinical issues as well as our spiritual and nourishing and job training and all of those kinds of things. So again, from this 5-country study, 67% of the women had diagnosable post-traumatic stress disorder. 58% had been victims of sexual abuse as children, with more than 4 people perpetrating this sexual abuse, minimum of 4. 72% were homeless. 92% wanted to leave prostitution if there was a program somewhere that would help them get out of prostitution. 92% said, "I'd leave. I would leave in a second." 72% wanted refuge, wanted a home, wanted a place where they could go and just rest and, you know, start to get healthy again. 70% wanted job training. They wanted to get out. They knew they needed something, some kind of training. They wanted to get out. Now, some people might argue, well, you know, is this really a human rights concern? I mean, if a person, let's say she entered consensually and voluntarily and she went and signed up and she thought she was going to be a dancer, you know, sometimes we hear that argument. Is that really a human rights issue? And I would argue, yes, it is. It is a human rights issue. Because the reality of this situation is that there are powerful social conditions which mediate this process. First of all, a lot of women enter what we call survival sex when they're that poor and that desperate. And it might be to feed their children. It might be to support impoverished families. Often you'll hear, she goes for the family. She goes to get the money and thinks, I'll just do this for 4 years or 5 years and I'll come back and then everything will be okay and my family will be out of their poverty. In many countries, $50,000 here is like $500,000 in their country or more. They also want to survive economically. A lot of women have escaped domestic violence, only to again, because of what happens in domestic violence, to again get into a violent situation because they haven't gotten the proper treatment or help with their problem. Many have entered this as a child, this condition as a child. Again, studies go as high as 2/3 of the women have suffered sexual abuse as children, so it's a continuing condition of their life. And so they enter and keep going through that condition. Another thing is, in some countries, you're supposed to. It's okay. They encourage you. It's your duty to go out and help the family if your family's in poverty. And if you have a lot of daughters, daughters are devalued. They're not worth a lot in many countries. So it's your duty to go help your family out of this poverty, however you can. And it may even be sanctioned by the parents, and they might even sell you for a very low price to get out and do this. So as you see, once you get to this place, a lot of times you haven't had education, you have not had obviously good therapy or the clinical needs met, the spiritual needs met, you've had terrible health conditions, so it becomes virtually no job training, no support systems, especially when you're trafficked, there's no one there. How do you get out? I mean, it's almost virtually impossible. And what we'll talk about tomorrow is what has been the slow lack of response, and why has there been a slow lack of response, and why is there no way for people to get out of this. And when I talk about Genesis House, again, we were one of the first organizations in the world in 1983 to offer quality programming for women to get out, and there's very few. I mean, the fact that we're the largest in the United States tells you how few there are that are offering this kind of programming. And again, on Thursday, I'll talk about we're willing, if anybody wants to start a program like this, wherever they live, we're willing to provide any type of information to help you with that. So a lot of times now they're diseased, they're sick, they've been in this for a while, they're traumatized or completely broken down mentally, spiritually. And at that point, it also becomes difficult to attract customers. So you become more and more desperate in what you're doing, and you take more and more risks in what you're doing. So, again, how could we exploit these people? Why? Who are the exploited? Why don't they have, you know, this kind of way to get out? They're female. They're young. They're poor. And often members of groups with a history of slavery in the history of that particular group. So often there's a mentality there already that exists about them. Again, they're children traumatized from sexual abuse, or they're women that I'm talking about have been trafficked or have immigrated from poor countries and then are taken advantage of when they get here. They're women who are addicted to drugs or alcohol, and so they're also desperate. It's very hard to get a regular job and go to regular work when you're addicted to drugs. You're not going to function well there. So prostitution is something you can manage while you're on drugs and alcohol. It's not the best situation, but it's something you can manage and make money at. And there are also women that are mentally ill. We see many women that are mentally ill. I've seen women that are literally delusional, walking the streets. They're obviously psychotic, and men will still pay them for sex. It doesn't matter if they're that sick, and they really need psychiatric treatment. They barely know what's happening to them or what's going on. It's very, very common in this country, advantage of the mentally ill woman. In the global south and east, the victims are young women and girls. Again, remember, as young as 7, it's been documented, who are desperately, desperately poor. That is the common denominator. And, again, some of the cultures expect them to sacrifice. If they're a girl, they should sacrifice themselves for the well-being of their family. That's extremely common attitude. And their communities, some of the communities condone this, for them to do this. So what is the global, what would you say the global sex industry preys on? It preys on sexual, racial, socioeconomic inequality. That's what just keeps it going. That's what keeps that engine and that fire burning. And it profits from it. Organized crime profits from this. It really is a social justice issue and a human rights issue that we should all care about, I think. It reinforces this inequality, it keeps it going, and it turns this exploitation to the groups that, where are these groups? They're at the bottom of the gender, race, socioeconomical based hierarchies. That's where they are. They're at the bottom. And it makes inequality immensely profitable for them. So I'd like to open this up for discussion, questions.
You mentioned a Chinese woman who escaped and turned herself in, found help. Was she deported back to China after?
That wasn't in the readings. And again, I passed this around yesterday, but for those who weren't here, this is actually a map, and I didn't get an opportunity to copy it, that shows which countries contributed going to which part of the United States. It's very interesting. I mean, we've got it pinned down to this kind of degree. And I'll just pass it around so you can see how much is going on. I didn't hear about that, but when I was working with the FBI in Chicago, I do know if you're going to be a witness, and imagine with all this information that's been published, she was a witness, they will protect you and give you special status while you're witnessing against organized crime in this country.
Yeah, someone who entered the country illegally and was engaged in criminal activity, even though they were victimized by it, they're out of here. I mean, so that's works against them turning themselves into the authorities.
They're working in one of the, when I get into solutions or ways we're attacking, they're working on a special status visa right now. And I can't remember, it's another letter and number like the ones I took earlier.
Asylum or something.
Right, and it's a special status visa for those who've been trafficked. And that is right now being discussed. And I think there are developing monies for this, and there's laws about it. So they're starting to go a little easier, but it's normally if you're going to witness. If you're not going to witness, or you can't witness, normally then you will be deported. And again, we look at the fact that what kind of care are you getting and what happens to you. After you've experienced this, how welcome are you? I told yesterday a story, a girl comes back raped, pregnant, has a 2-year-old child by someone she doesn't know. Where is she going to fit into her village now, her little small village, and how is she going to be looked at, and what happens to her? And there doesn't seem to be any safety net at all from what we can discern in this country. It's because people are just starting to see it's such a horrible problem, but nothing's really set up or organized. They're sort of randomly domestic violence shelters, homeless shelters, relatives if they have them. There's no real way that it's done in some order and that you know they got some kind of help and treatment for what's happened, for the trauma.
It occurred to me that, every so often I hear the stories about, if you were in your own country, say you're a woman in your own country, and you get raped, you get arrested, I would expect that maybe even more so if you've been forced into prostitution. It is a form of rape. And you've already defiled yourself because you've been seen as sort of committing adultery. That's what I think the whole thing with rape, and if you get raped, you get arrested because you were committing adultery. And I would guess that would happen too.
In some countries, like we talked about Afghanistan, for one, it's very much like that. That you it's your fault. And we talked about, too, that virgins are often raped repeatedly when they initially come, so they get used to that kind of behavior and treatment. This Mexican girl was a virgin who came to pick fruit, and that was one of the things. They raped her and raped her and raped her and raped her to desensitize her so she would work, because she kept crying and begging to go back to Mexico. And one thing they told her, which I didn't mention yesterday, was, we'll say that you stole money from us. We'll say that you stole $10,000 from us, and we'll turn you in as a criminal. I mean, the things they do are horrible, just horrible.
I heard you mention that most of the women are from unwealthy homes. Are some from wealthy homes? And I have another question also. I heard you mention if they make $25, they earn $3. How do they live? Do they live like in one big building and the traffickers clothes and feeding?
Right. In trafficking, it's universally poor women, and often they live where they have the customers. So they might be given a clean set of sheets at night just to change the sheets, but They normally have to live, because it's hidden. It might be a storefront or something that's innocuous. You don't know what it is. And so normally, and they're kept in there. They're not supposed to go out. They're not supposed to be seen, you know, and so on. But trafficking, it's universally poverty is what it is.
So what's the working lifespan of these women and girls, and what happens to them after the organization has decided they're used up?
Well, in New York, for example, some of the women try and get out and have legitimate businesses when they... Also, the traffickers would recognize when they're getting too old. I mean, the same sort of sexism exists in prostitution that exists, you know, worldwide. So she might try and become a madam and run the brothel. She might have an associated business and get out of it like a nail, you know, do your nails kind of thing. But some of them can save some amount of money and get out. It's unusual for them really actually to go back to their country after they've been involved in it for a long time. They just try and look at ways to save money and get out of there when they start to get older. And it's, I mean, a number of different ways. But that would be one, either to be rise up in the organization so they're over the other... You know, they're controlling it like a madam, or they sort of a related business they get into.
I read somewhere that there's a 9.5-year life expectancy if once you're working in the streets, that your life expectancy is short, so you die. That's how you get out of your
right.
job.
Or, again, you get so unappealing that you're no longer valued to the trafficker, and he might just release you, but release you to what? You know, if you're no longer really going to make money for them, you have no value anymore. But some, I mean, there are interviews with women who have done that, either become madams or eventually, you know, when they got older, open nail, you know, things and sort of associated bars, I mean, associated businesses if they had some money. If they had money at the end of it.
Are you going to tell us some about the young women and girls who get caught in prostitution from within the country?
Yes.
Is that on a different day?
That's Thursday. That's when we talk about Genesis House and our response, because I think that kind of prostitution is different from trafficking, but we'll describe our programming and who we see and what happens. We even see, in terms of trafficking, girls from Midwestern towns trafficked by pimps to Chicago.
Could you just give us an idea of the approximate number per year that get involved from within the country?
Well,
do we know?
In Chicago, they estimate there's something like between around 40,000 men, women, and children and transgenders involved in prostitution. So that would be all of, you know, young boys, transgenders, women, and girls. And then again, there's trafficking from, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa, Indiana, with pimps who go either to campuses or high school and recruit girls and bring them to Chicago, or runaways. They recruit runaways in bus stations and places like that. So that's a lot different. No, not a lot different. It's different kind of than the trafficking issue. And that's who we would be seeing in our programming and looking at. And we're seeing younger and younger girls in our outreach efforts. We saw nearly 13,000 last year, women and girls in our programming. And we're seeing younger and younger because we keep all that data and statistics. A lot of runaways.
So I know places like Genesis House are doing rehabilitation programs. You said that Genesis House is also collecting data. And are there other places that are collecting data or doing investigations?
The bigger places are collecting some good data, like San Francisco SAGE program. Minneapolis has a program. Toronto has a program. So it sort of depends on what they're collecting. I think we collect what most researchers are collecting. It's more in depth probably, because we do collect psych, we do collect domestic violence, we collect sexual abuse, HIV status, health status. We collect probably what most national researchers, if they're doing it, are collecting. Some places aren't collecting all that. We're looking at age, you know, just a lot of different things like that. And again, to sort of all of us, I'm trying to form a network where we impact social policy by collecting this data. And obviously we're against legalization of prostitution for all those reasons. But so I think you get stronger when you have numbers behind you. And the truth is nobody really cared to collect data. I mean, you would see for years like a six-month study from a university with a small control group where you'll see a lot of it, but when you really look at it, it's not 15 years back or 10 years back. So it gets more validity the more of us that band together at organizations. None of us have done that yet. I've just been visiting the other organizations in the country trying to encourage them. If we could all get on the same page, we could impact social policy a little bit more. Although the federal government has recognized prostitution as an issue, whereas most states, it'll still be mental health, you know, domestic violence, substance abuse, you know, they'll have these five or six homelessness, five or six pots, and then you have to fit your program into one of those pots. You know, so, you know, I don't know, I guess this pot, and you have to, you know, sort of meld what you're doing into something it really isn't to get funding. But the federal government does recognize prostitution as an issue and does fund it, which is why, and mostly through public health initiatives. I mean, concerns about public health. So that's where that funding comes from. And I think, unfortunately, HIV, I don't think there would have been as much funding if it hadn't been for HIV/AIDS, which is real negative because I think people tend to make it not an issue to really give funding to a lot or smaller funding. But with the health concerns, now there has been more funding. But that's why. I mean, public health concerns. Not because people care a lot more in Washington, I don't think.
Have you worked much with women from overseas at Genesis House?
No, we haven't. We're just beginning the trafficking initiative now. Just became more and more aware of it. And why? It was interesting because people keep calling us as the largest organization in the Midwest and say, what do you know about this? What do you know about this? And we realized that it was something that we really need to know about and be a clearinghouse for. There's only a clearinghouse in New York and San Francisco for trafficking. So just now we're beginning the research with the INS and with the FBI and other organizations and shelters to try and put together programming. And again, it's so hidden. You know, even when the FBI comes and interviews, you know, you have to be a Cambodian-speaking male or female to infiltrate this neighborhood where they would even trust you to know that this is where these women are being held. I've personally gone to Korean bars, and it's really very much like it is in Asia. You know, it's just life was transformed back to Asia. You know, the women are sitting around the bar, and when a customer comes in, they get up and they sit next to him, and it's very similar to Asia. So I have been personally to see where they're working. But again, one of the issues is also that if they begin to make money in the United States, it's sometimes they don't know what else to do or where to go. So they're not going to voluntarily say, I'll quit doing this. I'll quit working at this bar. I mean, there's a lot of other layers of issues that happen once they're here and they're established in something like that. But we've just started. But we're seeing it and we're hearing it, and the FBI is making arrests and protecting witnesses. So we're starting to get that, to get our holding center or our together. That's what we're working on now. But it's very, very, it's undercover. And remember, organized crime's involved. And when we work with the FBI and the INS, they're not going to tell us. They want to keep what they do secret, too, how they find them. So they're not going to, this is how we find them. You know, it's all very, very secretive. But so we're working on the end of, once you find them, can we have them and can we help them? That's the end we're working on.
I have a question. It's sort of an odd question here, but, you know, prostitution's been around forever and ever and ever. And so, I don't know which Northern European country it is where prostitution is legal.
The Netherlands.
And so, you know, and I don't know hardly anything about it except just this one old thing I've heard about. It sounds like the women there who are prostitutes have a lot more control over the whole scene of what they're doing. Is that totally not true? I mean, it doesn't sound like they're trapped in this whole thing like...
Well, they've begun research on that now with the trafficking, and ironically enough, most of the women that are prostitutes in Amsterdam are not from Amsterdam.
Right. This woman was an American woman who had gone over there and was raising her child over there as a prostitute. Mm-hmm. And she worked in the day, during the day.
They stand in the windows.
Yeah.
There are groups, and Kaya in the States that's very vocal about the legalization of prostitution. And I think that you almost have to go to a higher level and say, is this a really good thing for women?
Right.
You know, and again, it's organized crime, controlling prostitution, and what does it perpetuate?
Mm-hmm.
Do we really think prostitution is going to be eradicated in our lifetime? No, of course not. But I think the real issues are, we're not for arresting the women, but we're not for legalization. We're more for decriminalization or some form of it, where it's not a crime for women to be involved, but it's automatically where she would be offered help services. The money that goes into incarceration and so on would be given to help her if she so chooses. And again, 89% to 92% want to get out. So this might be one person that's happy in prostitution, but the fact that she's supporting her child goes back to what I was saying about survival sex as well. And I think if you get into an ideal situation, I don't think if women had equal opportunities and all of that, you know, she'd really have to support her child by being a prostitute. So again, you look at the socioeconomic factors. I mean, that might be working for her now, but is it really the ideal? But again, you know, we're not out to pull people off of corners who don't want to come off of corners. If you want help, that's what we want to give you. But the fact remains, I think if more women got help, there'd be a lot less women in prostitution. And I think, yes, it'll always exist in some form until, you know, utopia or something happens where people are at much higher levels with relating to each other and where there is more equality and things like that. But there are, I mean, Coyote's very vocal in this country as well. But, you know, I still, when you look at the statistics that we've just started to keep about what happened to you in your childhood, again, you might accept it now, but is that okay? You know, what happened to you so you're comfortable in prostitution now? But I really think it's a stretch to say it's an emotionally healthy vocation for a woman. I think that'd be a real stretch. I'm not saying they're mentally ill, but I don't think it's something that leads to your health, your mental health.
I found it interesting that you mentioned when a woman is picked up, it costs us money, whereas if the John is picked up, we can actually make money if we're finding them. And I can't believe that, you know, people haven't seen the light of this. We're always trying to make money in politics and in government, and, you know, any non-CEO person would figure this out. So, you know, I don't get it. But so what's being done to help, or maybe you're going to talk about this tomorrow, what's being done to help promote that concept that, you know, make the John pay?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, one of the big issues is we're in a patriarchal society, and a lot of the customers are politicians and police officers and judges and lawyers and professional white males. I mean, so these are the guys making the laws. And also, I mean, a good percentage of men who see prostitutes are married. And so there's sympathy among married men. You know, we don't want you to get caught, or, you know, there's some protection going on there, mutual protection. So I think the only thing that I've seen that might kind of work and make some sense is the John's programs, as I talked about, in San Francisco and Toronto, where you look at it as a problem, an issue, a concern for counseling instead of a punitive shaming. You got caught, you're evil, we're going to print your name, you know, and do all these horrible things to this. Again, that's real like witch hunt, that, you know, stuff. Salem, you know, let's put a red letter on him. That's not going to change behavior. It makes you sneaky and it makes you angry. I mean, we know that. So the John's programs really address, why are you doing this? You know, what happened to you that you treat women this way? And it's a number of different people speak, you know, the law speaks about, this is what's going to happen to you legally. You're going to be in big trouble if we catch you again.
Then public health educators speak about sexually transmitted diseases, and then it gets softer as the day goes on, and women, female, former prostitutes talk about what that felt like for them and how they felt about them, and that's very moving for most of them, and what messages are they giving to daughters. And then an expert, usually a male therapist, speaks on sexual compulsivity and offers therapy. And actually, what's the Women's Network Lifetime? I watched it about a month ago because it was actually Harry Hamlin and his wife. And it was a true story on a doctor who suffered from sexual compulsivity and who was arrested. And she went to pick him up and got his keys for some reason and then found that he had an apartment with pornography. And when she was standing at the door, the guard who kind of watched for him came up to her and said, "You don't look like most of the women who come to visit him." And she was like, "Ah." So she goes inside and sees all this, that he has a total secret life. And it was based on the John's program idea, and they told him he either could, you know, go through with his sentencing or he could go into therapy. And he didn't want to go into the counseling, but he knew as a doctor the whole community would know and so on. But he didn't want to. He didn't think he had a problem. And it's a true story, and I thought it was great because it brought it to light that some, you know, we think of the males as not having a problem, but many do have a problem. And his oldest son hated him in the story because the son had to witness a lot of this stuff, that he was lying to the mother. And it turned out, as a child, his dad had done the same thing, you know, taken him to the prostitute, said, "Sit in the car, Jimmy, you know, don't tell your mom, we're at a baseball game," and so on. And so he grew up to be exactly like his dad. I mean, and I thought it was a pretty good, you know, for Lifetime, I thought, well, that's pretty good because it really showed, you know, the man isn't always feeling macho and feeling like he's a great guy or he has sexual prowess when he's doing these things. You know, there may, let's consider that there might be a problem here that needs treatment and that a person wants treatment for, instead of just being punitive about it. But it's so hard for that person to ask for treatment and to get treatment for whatever his issues are with women. And again, you look at a guy like this, what possible messages is he sending to a daughter? You know, what possibly could he be, you know, and who knows what she's going to grow up to be like. So, I mean, there's all these other ramifications on the customer end as well that I think need to be addressed, because if you have someone providing the service and someone demanding the service, we need to be looking at both ends of that spectrum, not just the woman is bad, let's punish her. Yeah. Doesn't make a lot of sense. But again,
it's the blame the victim mentality.
Sure. I mean, there wouldn't be a service if it wasn't demanded. It's very clear cut. Any other questions? Question?
Well, the Frederick Delacoste has this interesting book called Sex Work, which is all writing. I like it because it's writings by women who work in the sex industry in their, so that in their own voice and telling their own stories. I recommend it. It's interesting reading. She's sort of the women can choose to do sex work if they want out of a place of strength, not necessarily out of a place of weakness. And she has some women in that book who do testify to that point of view, and they talk about how they were victimized by being sexually abused as children and are raped or repeatedly raped or somehow losing control of their sexuality, and saying that as prostitutes they feel like they get control because they can negotiate the deal. They can say, "I will do exactly this, this, and this, and not anything else in return for X amount of money. I won't kiss, I won't, you know, whatever."
That's real common. That's part of the addiction to the lifestyle.
And so then they talk about that as a method of sort of regaining control over something. And I would imagine that's a step on life's way, you know.
Well, it's a defense mechanism. I mean, we all create defense mechanisms, you know, to, you know, if there's a trauma in our lives. And that's a very common, I mean, you'll hear most prostitutes, whatever level they're at, will say that, you know, that that's the way they got control, or they got money for what was being taken from them, you know, without their permission in the past. again, that doesn't necessarily mean it's healthy.
No.
I mean, but it is a reaction, and it's a pretty common reaction. And it's understandable, you know, well, you took this from me, now I'm going to get money from it, and I'm going to be in control, and I'm going to tell you what to do. So that's not uncommon, but again, I think it's a defense mechanism, it's a form of denial. I mean, it's some other kinds of things, but it can be a step on the road. Who knows? I mean, maybe that's what, you know, again, to get where they need to get next. But that's pretty common.
Hmm.
I have something called the Brothel Bible, which is similar, about, you know, it's written by someone who's in Las Vegas. And
well, by far the majority of the voices that speak in Delacoste's book are voices out of terror and pain and you know, hopelessness and dysfunction and stuff.
It's a good defense mechanism for a while. I mean, you know, defense mechanisms protect the ego, and that's why we create them, or our ego would be too scarred, be awful. So we have to do something.
I just want to say thank you for what you do, because it's not easy.
Thank you.
You know, how long can you do it? Because you've got to take it home with you.
Well, you know, I think it's that old thing. Is every time someone gets well and healthy, it just gives you fuel. I mean, it's. I think there's that card in the bookshop, and I really liked it. It said, what was it, Wanda, about the dark and the candle? What is it? It was better to light one candle than to sit in the dark.
Oh.
And that really appealed to me, because I thought, it's so true. I mean, it's better to do something. I mean, even if you make a tiny dent, than to just sit there and say, it's too overwhelming, I can't do anything about it. And like I say, each time a person gets healthy and leaves us and goes on their way and resumes a happy, healthy life, that's what makes it worthwhile. You know? And they come back and work for us, too. So. Okay, well, tomorrow, 3:45, what is being done about this problem? And again, all the handouts will be the same for every lecture in the series. So if you've got the handout, that's the only one that there is. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.